The Economist for the week of January 3rd to 9th, 2026. Welcome back to The Deep Dive. I'm Jamie Wilson.
And I'm Ronnie Bettis.
And we have, well, an enormous stack of sources to get through this week. We're really going cover to cover, guiding you through everything from some very high-stakes geopolitical brinkmanship to these massive financial bubbles in AI, and then all the way down to some, you know, pretty unexpected cultural fallout from weight loss drugs.
It's a great stack, and I think our mission today is really critical. It's to provide the context that connects all these events because they can seem so isolated.
Right.
This week's news isn't just a collection of headlines. It's a portrait of extreme instability. You've got the promises of political rhetoric on one side.
And the reality of what's happening underneath on the other.
Exactly. The underlying economic structures.
Yeah.
And they're constantly at war. So we really need to analyze the specifics and, you know, the long-term implications for you, the listener.
Okay. Let's unpack that instability. We should probably start right at the top with the geopolitical scene, which is, let's say, volatile.
Yeah.
And it's still very much dominated by the diplomatic drama around Donald Trump.
Specifically, his meetings down in Florida.
Yes, exactly. The most immediate one, of course, was his session with Vladimir Zelensky. This was all about finding some kind of resolution to the Ukraine war.
A war that just keeps grinding on.
And Zelensky, you can tell he's desperate for some kind of concrete, long-term commitment from the West. He was pushing really hard for this massive 50-year security guarantee.
But the thing that stands out here is just the extreme, I guess, cognitive dissonance between the process and the reality.
Yeah, what do you mean by that?
Well, you have these high-level talks, and they're supposedly making progress. But at the same time, Trump is trying to navigate this incredibly thorny question, as the source puts it, of whether Russia gets to keep the territory it seized.
Which is a complete non-starter for any real peace deal.
It's a fundamental hurdle. And at the exact moment this diplomatic theater is playing out, Russia launches one of its most severe attacks of the war.
So while they're talking, Kiev is under fire.
500 drones, 40 missiles, a million homes near Kiev without power. The talks are, in real time, failing to deter anything.
And this aggressive posturing wasn't just limited to Eastern Europe. Trump's Middle East strategy, which came out of his meeting with Netanyahu, was just as blunt.
Very blunt. He demanded Hamas disarm completely. That was the non-negotiable condition for any kind of Gaza peace deal.
But then he raised the stakes even further with Iran.
Dramatically. He explicitly warned Tehran that if it even thought about resuming its weapons program, the U.S. would support another attack.
That kind of aggressive U.S. stance, it feels like it emboldens other actors to make their own daring moves.
And potentially destabilizing ones, yes. I think the biggest diplomatic shock this week was Israel becoming the first country in the world to recognize Somaliland as a sovereign state.
And they explicitly tied it to the Abraham Accords, didn't they?
They did. They're trying to frame it as expanding this regional alignment of powers.
And that, of course, sent immediate ripples through the region. Somalia, understandably, condemned it immediately, said it threatens their sovereignty.
But then China weighed in, and they stated very firmly that they oppose any attempt to split Somalia.
Okay, so why does China care so much about the sovereignty of a state in the Horn of Africa? What's their angle?
Oh, it's entirely strategic. Somaliland sits right on the Gulf of Aden, which is, you know, a crucial choke point for all maritime trade.
Oil, container shipping.
Yeah.
Everything going through the Red Sea and the Suez Canal.
Exactly. So China sees a unified Somalia as vital for its broader influence in the region, especially as it competes with rising Indian and Turkish interests.
So Israel's move, tying it to the Abraham Accords,
it effectively links Red Sea security and these new Israeli-Arab interests directly into the whole volatile Sino-Somali relationship. It's a huge new geopolitical friction point.
And if we zoom out just a little, you can see other coalitions in the region starting to fray as well.
This is particularly visible in the Yemen civil war. The anti-Houthi coalition is basically tearing itself apart.
Right. The UAE-backed Southern Transitional Council, the STC, they just rejected a Saudi directive.
They did. Saudi Arabia told them to pull back from areas they'd seized near Aden, and the STC just said no.
Which led to alleged Saudi airstrikes against their own supposed allies.
Yes. And this just deepens the rift that's been growing between Saudi Arabia and the UAE over who has influence in Yemen and the wider peninsula. It weakens the whole effort to stabilize the country.
Meanwhile, the U.S. confirmed it's still conducting military actions elsewhere. In Africa, for example.
The Nigerian government approved America's recent missile strikes against Islamic State camps in the north. They're hoping to stop militants from moving south out of the Sahel.
But then there was the much more chilling revelation about Venezuela.
Yes, the previously unknown direct CIA drone strike, confirmed by Trump. It was on a drug gang's port facility in Venezuela.
Okay, so what's the real significance there?
Well, it's twofold. First, it's a strike against a non-state actor, a drug gang, but inside a sovereign nation. And second, the location. It's in the Americas.
Right.
And while the strike reportedly didn't injure anyone, it sets an extremely aggressive precedent for the U.S. to carry out these kinds of internal security actions in Latin America. It's a real expansion of how they're defining national security enforcement.
And finally, just to round out this global picture, the military posturing around Taiwan just keeps escalating.
China conducted massive live-round military exercises.
Mm-hmm.
They essentially encircled the island. And Beijing was very explicit about it. They framed it as a serious warning to separatists.
And this is a direct response to Taiwan accepting its biggest ever U.S. weapons package.
An $11 billion deal. So this action just underscores the buildup, the tension, and the real immediate risk of miscalculation in the region. The whole global stage is just. It's set with high-stakes political poker, fractured alliances, and military escalation almost everywhere you look.
And all of this, this overwhelming global instability, the military spending, the trade tensions, it feeds directly into the week's central domestic debate, especially in the U.S. and Europe, this whole question of economic anxiety and the affordability crisis.
Okay, let's dive right into this affordability crisis debate because it is just completely dominating the political conversation.
Affordability is being tipped as the word of the year for 2026 politics.
It's the early favorite for sure. The Democrats are clearly using this sense of crisis against Trumpism. But the fundamental challenge for any politician is that voters, well, they hold maddeningly contradictory desires.
They want low prices when they're at the store, but high wages for their job. And they want high house prices if they're selling, but low ones if their kids are trying to buy. It makes rational policy almost impossible.
Exactly. And this is where the economic evidence becomes so important. Because, and this is counterintuitive, the so-called affordability crisis in America is, for the most part, a mirage.
A mirage. How so?
The clearest measure of genuine affordability is real wages. So how much your paycheck actually buys after you account for inflation?
And what's the trend there?
It's been rising steadily for a decade. Real wages have hit record highs. And this is especially true for the poorest workers. Their purchasing power is objectively better than it has ever been. Even the post-pandemic inflation spike didn't derail that long-term trend.
Okay, but if the data says people are wealthier, why is the sentiment so overwhelmingly negative? Why does the cost of living dominate every conversation?
It's psychological and it's structural. Yep. People are most sensitive to the cost of things they buy all the time. The necessities, food and energy.
Right, groceries.
For groceries, prices have pretty much tracked overall inflation. You get spikes in specific things like eggs because of bird flu, but overall it's in line. The energy picture, though, is a bit more nuanced.
Electricity costs have definitely gone up. That's a real pain point for people.
They have. They've outstripped inflation significantly since 2019. And politicians love to just blame it on the new AI data centers.
But the sources say that's too simple, right?
It is an unfair simplification. The more likely culprits are, one, the immense cost of modernizing the power grid for renewables, and two, and this is crucial, the growing exports of liquefied natural gas, LNG.
How does exporting gas make my electricity bill go up?
When the U.S. exports LNG, it ties domestic gas prices to the higher global market prices, like in Europe. That increases the fuel costs for American power plants. So it's less about Silicon Valley and more about global energy markets and infrastructure investment.
And then there's the other side of the energy coin, petrol, which everyone is acutely aware of.
Precisely. And this is what pundits often miss. Petrol prices at the pump have actually fallen since 2019.
Fallen?
Yes. And that decline has more than outweighed the rising cost of electricity. So overall, consumer energy costs are more stable than the headlines suggest. But a rising electricity bill gets a lot more political attention.
Okay, so if the crisis isn't really driven by groceries or gasoline, where is the most legitimate source of financial pain coming from?
There are two main areas. The first is housing. No question. Particularly in those superstar cities. Land is scarce, and restrictive zoning rules have artificially choked off supply for decades.
And the numbers are bad.
The numbers are staggering. In Manhattan and Brooklyn, the combined cost of a mortgage, insurance, and tax on an average property it could exceed 90% of the average household's pre-tax income.
90%? That's unsustainable.
Completely. The second area is the cost of services relative to goods. Thanks to global supply chains, you know, a flat-screen TV is incredibly cheap.
Right.
But services, childcare, elder care, even just a haircut, they're local and labor-intensive. Their rising cost actually reflects the increasing prosperity and rising wages of the people doing those jobs.
So in a weird way, these are problems of affluence, a competition for scarce things like a house in a good school district, not a sign of fundamental poverty.
That's the core insight. And the final undeniable legitimate grievance is high interest rates, the price of money.
When the Fed jacked up rates?
When the Fed aggressively raised rates to fight inflation, it flowed directly into painfully expensive credit card debt, steeper car loans, higher mortgage costs. This is the legitimate global grievance. And research shows that if you actually factor borrowing costs into inflation, it completely explains why consumer confidence is so depressed despite high wages and low unemployment.
And this combination of real anxiety and a perceived crisis creates a huge political danger.
The biggest danger. If politicians respond to the sentiment instead of the reality, they risk bringing in harmful, discredited policies.
That's the crucial risk, isn't it? The risk isn't that prices are too high. They're going to stay elevated unless we have a deep recession. The risk is that politicians reach for these damaging short-term fixes.
Things like price controls or rent caps. History has proven they just make shortages worse. Mm-hmm. Even doing the sensible things like rolling back Trump's tariffs or easing up on immigration crackdowns is politically difficult.
So what's the rational path?
The only rational path, and it's politically unsatisfying, is to simply allow time for real wages to keep rising and for voters to adjust to the new normal of higher nominal prices.
That American context is crucial. But let's hop across the Atlantic, because Europe has a related but subtly different economic problem. While America has an affordability mirage, Europe is dealing with what the sources call an availability crisis.
And that is a very important distinction. Europe definitely has inflation worries. High energy and food costs after the Ukraine war pushed inflation over 10% in 2022.
But the structure of their markets is different.
Very different. Europe's highly regulated markets often stop prices from fully reflecting demand and balancing supply. And when prices can't rise enough to incentivize new supply, you just get physical scarcity.
And that scarcity shows up as rationing by time and effort. The most frustrating example for the average person is probably getting access to services, especially healthcare.
Precisely. You see it so clearly in the wait times. Only 35% of French patients can see a medical specialist in under a month.
And in America.
It's 57%. And this shortage goes way beyond healthcare. Across Europe, there are severe shortages of electricians, plumbers, nurses, even cooks.
So Europeans might have rising purchasing power on paper, but they're getting more and more disgruntled because when they actually try to spend that money on a service like getting their kitchen renovated or seeing a doctor, they just can't find anyone to do it.
It's the difference between having the money to buy dinner and finding out every restaurant is booked for the next 3 weeks. And this is going to get worse with Europe's aging workforce. As that huge cohort of skilled workers retires, the availability crisis will only intensify.
This economic anxiety, this feeling of things not working, it drives us seamlessly into the financial risks we're seeing in tech, especially with the staggering amount of capital being poured into artificial intelligence.
The generative AI startup scene is running on pure adrenaline, and what some sources are calling the towering inferno of AI capital.
That phrase really captures the atmosphere.
It does. Despite all the worries about a bubble, the private market frenzy just kept going through 2025. VCs poured $150 billion into big AI startups.
And now OpenAI is reportedly looking for even more.
A lot more. Up to $100 billion in 2026, which would value the company at an astronomical $830 billion.
That scale is just mind-boggling, but it's being financed by an equally mind-boggling level of spending.
Absolutely. The cash drain at OpenAI is operating at towering inferno rates. Leaked figures suggest the company expects to burn through $17 billion in 2026. That's nearly double the $9 billion they burned in 2025.
And most of that is on computing power.
The need for chips, data centers, cloud infrastructure. It's immense. And right now, those costs are still tightly coupled to revenue growth. They've signed letters of intent for another 30 gigawatts of capacity. That's a speculative commitment of $1.4 trillion. They have to prove they can turn that spending into sustainable profit, not just bigger and bigger losses.
And their early lead is being seriously challenged by big tech.
That's the key structural risk for a company like OpenAI. The idea that any one AI lab has a durable, long-term competitive moat is being tested every single day.
Because companies like Google have so much cash.
They're cash gushers. And they can leverage their own internal infrastructure, their own custom chips, their own cloud, to make their models dramatically more efficient to train and run. We just saw Google's Gemini 3 outperform OpenAI's GPT 5.1 on several key benchmarks. The performance gap is closing fast.
So given that intense competition, how does a company like OpenAI solve the monetization problem, especially when so many people are using the free version of ChatGPT?
This is the inference cost problem. Inference, just running the models to give users an answer, it's expensive, especially for non-paying users. But if OpenAI tries to cut their losses by raising prices or giving shorter, less useful answers,
they risk degrading the user experience and pushing people to competitors.
Exactly. So that forces them towards vertical integration.
Yeah.
Have to start designing their own custom chips, develop more sophisticated enterprise tools, and explore new ways to monetize, maybe through advertising or e-commerce, built right into the chatbot.
The whole atmosphere around this level of spending and valuation, it seems to be driven by a kind of defiant hubris.
It really is. The sources note that just talking about cash burn is reportedly taboo inside OpenAI's executive team.
Right. And Sam Altman, the CEO, even said he wants to see the company go public just to watch the doubters get burned.
That strategy, burning capital at an unheard-of rate while daring the world to bet against you, has drawn some really scathing criticism. Some analysts are calling it the WeWork story on steroids.
That's a harsh comparison. WeWork's collapse was spectacular.
It was. And it's a huge warning sign about financial discipline in this AI gold rush.
That's a dramatic caution about speculative capital. Mm-hmm. But while frontier AI is burning money, it seems like other perennial technologies, the ones we've been told are always years away, are finally becoming viable businesses.
And here's where we see a genuine turning point. Technologies like fusion energy, quantum computing, and electric vertical takeoff and landing, aircraft eVTOLs or flying cars, they're finally shedding that science fiction reputation.
Right. We're seeing actual launches and huge valuations. Joby Aviation is now valued at $12 billion. They're scheduled to launch air taxi services in Dubai soon.
And EHang, a Chinese competitor, already has licenses for commercial sightseeing tours in China. The infrastructure is becoming real.
And in the energy sector, the fusion race is heating up dramatically.
It is. Startups like Helion and Commonwealth Fusion Systems, CFS, they've signed actual contracts to provide firm power to giants like Microsoft and Google by the early 2030s. This isn't just research anymore. This is infrastructure planning.
The timeline of the early 2030s. That means the fundamental challenges must be shifting from scientific problems to engineering problems. What enabled the shift?
It's a combination of things. For fusion, the huge advance is high-temperature superconductors. They allow for much stronger magnetic fields to contain the plasma, but with less cooling power.
And for quantum computing?
Google has had a breakthrough, using more physical qubits to create a single, highly stable, logical qubit that dramatically cuts the error rates. They've basically proven that the core issue is now a matter of scalable engineering, not foundational physics.
And it seems like AI is playing a quiet but critical supporting role in all of this.
Absolutely. AI is essential for designing the advanced battery materials for the eVTOLs, correcting those quantum errors, and crucially, for controlling the notoriously fickle plasma inside a fusion reactor.
So it's not just one big breakthrough.
No, fundamentally, the shift is less about one eureka moment and more about the supply chain. These perennial technologies are now benefiting from robust, growing supply chains for their specialized components. CFS, for example, its reliable orders forced its superconductor suppliers to increase production 40-fold. That flow of components is what turns a lab discovery into a viable business.
That progression from speculative capital to viable technology is a powerful theme. Let's pivot now from high-tech speculation to the financial stability of the conglomerate built by one of history's greatest investors, a massive, very analog empire.
Yes, we have to talk about the transition at Berkshire Hathaway.
Yeah.
It's America's most unique company.
Yeah.
Warren Buffett, now 95, is stepping down on December 31st for what is presumably his final retirement.
And his legacy is just extraordinary. Since 1965, Berkshire shares have completely trounced the S&P 500, all built on his talent for spotting undervalued firms with strong moats.
Enduring competitive advantages. But the focus now shifts entirely to the future under his successor, Gregory Abel.
What are the immediate challenges that Abel is facing?
There are significant structural challenges. First, he's an operator, not a stock picker like Buffett.
Hmm.
He came up through the energy side of the business. Second, he has to deal with the recent departure of Todd Combs, one of the Buffett's key investment lieutenants, who left for J.P. Morgan Chase. That's a destabilizing move. And third, and maybe most pressing, is what to do with the company's colossal $380 billion cash pile.
That's an enormous amount of money to have just sitting there.
It is. And it's growing. The cost of letting it sit idle just gets higher as interest rates come down.
And what about Berkshire's role as a kind of system stabilizer during a crisis? That changes without the Oracle of Omaha, right? We hear about Buffett's Rolodex. What does that actually mean in financial terms?
The Rolodex isn't just a list of phone numbers. It represents unique personal trust and market confidence. Buffett's influence allowed him to be the true lender of last resort in moments of panic.
Like in 2008.
Exactly. When he injected capital into Goldman Sachs and General Electric, banks and regulators trusted him completely. Without that singular influence, Berkshire's power to intervene and stabilize a failing institution is severely diminished. It might transition from being an extraordinary company to a much more ordinary one.
And speaking of future crises, some analysts are warning that the U.S. financial system might be, well, teed up for the next one, that the kindling is already being laid.
That's the argument from figures like former banker Ken Miller. He's saying the system is structurally fragile, driven by this dangerous convergence of regulatory rollbacks and perverse incentives.
And what's the core failure, according to him?
He points to the effective shelving of a crucial Dodd-Frank provision, Section 956.
Can you just remind us what Section 956 was supposed to do?
It was designed after the 2008 crisis to curb incentive-based pay schemes that encouraged excessive risk-taking. It mandated that executive pay had to be clawed back if their risk-taking led to massive losses. By shelving that, Wall Street basically went right back to its pre-2008 culture.
So executives and traders get rewarded for short-term profits, even if those profits are built on long-term systemic risk.
Precisely. And that risk-taking culture has now migrated out of the traditional banks and into the shadows.
The shadow banking sector.
Yes. That's where it's fueling these highly leveraged, unregulated non-bank institutions. The most prominent example is the multi-trillion dollar private credit market.
And critics are saying this is like the subprime mortgage boom all over again.
But on steroids. Instead of residential mortgages, they're using short-term debt to finance these long-term, illiquid corporate loans. The problem is these institutions are opaque, they're unregulated, and we won't know how bad the loans are until they sour, maybe a decade from now.
And at the same time, the government's ability to police this has been weakened.
Systematically weakened. The Trump administration prioritized replacing career enforcers with anti-regulators. This meant agencies like the CFPB and the SEC basically paused investigations and enforcement. That regulatory void allowed financial firms to take on huge amounts of risk for short-term profit. The kindling for the next financial fire is definitely ready.
That structural financial risk, It leads us pretty naturally to the geopolitics of global business, where trade is increasingly being defined by state action, not just market efficiency.
You see this so clearly in the wind power industry. Europe's domestic wind industry is facing an existential threat from Chinese turbine makers.
This is because of overcapacity at home in China, right? So makers like Goldwind and Mingyang are aggressively expanding overseas.
And they're selling their units much, much cheaper. They're making major inroads in Europe, even with all the political hostility.
So this is a classic case of China's goes global industrial policy, and it forces Western nations into a really difficult choice.
It does. Do you protect your domestic industry with tariffs and maybe slow down your transition to renewables? Or do you accept the cheaper, hyper-competitive Chinese supply chains to meet your climate goals but risk your economic security?
We're already seeing which way the market is leaning.
The recent deal that Octopus struck with Mingyang in Britain shows that often market efficiency wins out over political anxiety.
Okay, let's move to aviation, which has a totally different paradox. Airlines hit a record $40 billion global profit in 2025, way past pre-pandemic levels, and yet the net margin is minuscule, just $7.90 profit per passenger. Why?
The meager profit margin is directly linked to the failure of the Boeing-Airbus duopoly to deliver new planes. Combined deliveries in 2025 were far short of pre-pandemic records.
And Boeing is still struggling with quality control issues?
Still struggling post-737 MAX. And Airbus is facing its own production flaws and supply chain bottlenecks. This forces airlines to fly aging fleets. The average age is now 15 years, up from 13.
Which means higher operating and maintenance costs.
Drastically higher. It completely negates the fuel efficiency gains they'd get from new planes. And this shortfall isn't expected to be resolved until 2031, so margins will stay thin for years.
That kind of supply chain vulnerability forces all global firms to face what the sources are calling the patriotism test.
Right. The rise of economic nationalism means multinationals face these contradictory demands. They have to localize their operations for political loyalty at home, but they also had to compete globally by accessing the most efficient supply chains, which are often in China.
So Western firms invest in China not just to sell to the Chinese market, but for their own survival in the global marketplace.
Exactly. They are leveraging Chinese expertise and scale. But this creates a severe political hazard. What happens if a China-based subsidiary develops IP that security laws prevent it from sharing with its American parent? Or if the foreign operations start to cannibalize sales back home?
Then home governments start questioning whether what's good for the company is still good for the country.
The nationality of a global firm is becoming profoundly ambiguous. And companies have to constantly balance profit against political loyalty. This kind of complex environment requires some deft political maneuvering. Which brings us down to South America, where another charismatic politician is dominating the scene.
Right. Brazil's political crossroads are really dominated by the longevity and charisma of one man, President Lula. He's 80 years old and is the favorite for an unprecedented fourth term.
Lula's political survival is remarkable. In early 2025, his approval ratings were poor. There were lingering corruption scandals. But then his luck completely turned.
For first, his main opponent, Jair Bolsonaro, was jailed for plotting a coup.
And second, Donald Trump imposed these deeply unpopular punitive tariffs on Brazilian goods. This was after Bolsonaro's son lobbied the Trump circle and just rallied Brazilians around Lula as the protector of the national economy.
Trump has since walked back a lot of those tariffs, though.
He has. And he's even called Lula great, which just shows how quickly Lula's political fortunes have shifted.
But his age and his failure to groom a successor, that poses a huge risk to Brazil's democratic stability.
That is the core uncertainty. Lula has no serious challengers from the center or the left. Potential successors were passed over, deemed too cerebral by his inner circle. They want charisma and popular appeal. So like other aging leaders we see around the world, he's prioritizing his own immediate power over building institutional continuity for the nation.
And the political right is just completely disorganized without Bolsonaro.
Bolsonaro's attempt to anoint his son Flavio as his heir has been an abject failure. Flavio is widely seen as ineffective and unpopular. So that basically guarantees fragmentation on the right, which clears the path for Lula to cruise to a fourth term.
So what's the best hope for the Brazilian right?
It probably lies with Tarcísio de Freitas, the conservative governor of São Paulo. He's moderate, thoughtful, he respects the rule of law. But he needs Bolsonaro's explicit blessing to unite the center-right and provide a viable democratic alternative. It's still a very messy, uncertain situation.
And before we move on, this high-level contempt for political institutions, sadly, it's not unique to Brazil. You just have to look at Peru.
Right, where citizens are venting their fury against their notoriously corrupt leaders. Four ex-presidents are currently in jail by continuing this tradition of burning large effigies of public figures for the new year.
It's a powerful symbolic act of defiance.
And catharsis. The targets included recently jailed figures and the current interim president. This tradition just underscores the profound mistrust Peruvians have for their entire political class. When leaders fail, burning effigies becomes a necessary act of collective political expression.
From the effigies of failed leaders, let's turn to the spectacular historical fall of a Canadian institution, the Hudson's Bay Company, or HBC.
This past Christmas was the first holiday season without the HBC. It was liquidated back in June 2025. And this is so much more than a retail story. It's a foundational piece of Canadian history.
The HBC was granted dominion in 1670 over Rupert's Land, a territory that was a third of modern Canada, an area four times the size of the Holy Roman Empire.
And that history is fraught with colonial consequences. The company sold Rupert's Land to the new Canadian state in 1869 for just £300,000.
Without ever consulting the indigenous peoples who had sustained the original European adventurers and taught them how to survive.
And that history is still extremely raw today. The end of the HBC prompts deep resentment among indigenous leaders who see a direct parallel between the company's historical land grabs and modern rhetoric about Canadian sovereignty. The company's demise is a fresh reminder of its unsavory past.
Let's leave the Americas now and cross the Atlantic to examine European security and the increasingly precarious future of the UK-EU relationship.
We really need to focus on a major security flashpoint right now, and that's the Baltic Sea. The entire region is being called a deep trouble zone. It's just rich in critical infrastructure pipelines, fiber optic cables, LNG terminals, and extremely vulnerable to hybrid warfare.
And this threat isn't theoretical. It's concrete and persistent. There have been at least 11 suspected acts of Russian-linked sabotage since 2023.
And this often involves Russia's shadow fleet of tankers, the ships they use to get around sanctions. They'll intentionally drag their anchors across the seabed to rupture critical cables, like the Baltic Connector pipeline.
So what's the military challenge for NATO here?
It's immense. The alliance has conventional superiority on the surface, but tracking activity below the murky, cluttered seabed of the Baltic is extremely difficult. Conventional sonar just isn't well suited for it.
So they need new surveillance systems.
Integrated systems. Advanced submarines like the Swedish A-26 that Poland is planning to buy, and unmanned underwater vehicles. But developing and deploying these things faces years of delays. Sweden's first delivery, for example, is pushed back to 2031.
And the cost of doing nothing is staggering, which is forcing some immediate policy responses.
The costs are massive. Repairing a sabotaged telecom cable can cost 24 million euros a day. A major gas pipeline break can be 75 million euros a day.
So that's forcing NATO to consider more robust deterrence.
It is. Poland, for example, just passed legislation allowing its navy to use force to protect critical infrastructure, even outside its own territorial waters. They're invoking the right to national self-defense. It's a necessary step to clearly signal to Russia that these hybrid attacks will not be tolerated.
That pressing security threat, the instability on NATO's doorstep, it really forces Europe and Britain to reassess their relationship 5 years after the Brexit deal. And Britain is still grappling with what the sources call the lingering Brexit poison.
The economic analysis is stark, and it's consistent. Conservative estimates conclude that Brexit has already reduced Britain's GDP by between 4 and 8% compared to if they had remained.
And crucially, it completely failed to achieve its stated goal of curbing immigration.
Which has actually risen sharply. Brexit didn't cause Britain to immediately fall off a cliff. It was more like a slow-acting poison that magnified the country's chronic pre-existing weaknesses.
How did it magnify those flaws?
By reinforcing bad habits. Business investment just flatlined for 6 years after the 2016 vote, which locked in Britain's long-term tendency towards short-termism.
And the new non-tariff barriers. The paperwork, the checks.
They crushed global competitiveness in manufacturing. And while services exports did a bit better, they still suffered from new barriers, like complex licensing requirements. Mm. Instead of forcing reform, Brexit just distracted politicians and made the low growth trajectory worse.
Politically, the shift in public opinion is undeniable. A new survey shows 52% of Britons now think leaving was wrong. 55% want a closer trade relationship with the EU, even if it means new barriers with America.
And that has encouraged the Labour Party to acknowledge the economic damage more openly. But, and this is a big but, potential Prime Minister Starmer remains rigidly committed to his manifesto red lines.
No rejoining the single market, no customs union, no free movement.
Exactly. And that rigidity just hampers any chance for a genuine reset, even as threats from Russia and the unreliability of America under Trump demand closer European cooperation.
This political rigidity makes the story of Nigel Farage all the more ironic. The man who spent his life fighting the EU may actually be, in essence, Britain's most European politician.
It's deeply ironic. His entire political career is owed to the proportional representation system used for the European Parliament. It gave his UKIP party a foothold that Britain's own system never would have.
And beyond that, his lifestyle is very continental.
He's married to a German woman, has a French partner.
Yeah.
But his actual political views, surprisingly, align more closely with continental European thought than British thought.
On issues that are basically verboten in British politics.
Precisely. His dovish stance on Russia, for example, that's mainstream in Italy. And on healthcare, he's openly said the NHS is inefficient compared to continental systems and that an insurance-based model is superior.
That's an unthinkable position for a major British politician.
But it's common sense across the channel. He is the exemplar of a distinctly European style of populism. The man who pushed Britain out of Europe will never escape Europe himself.
This anxiety about the U.S. political commitment, which underpins the need for a UK-EU reset, brings us back to the growing fragility of transatlantic ties.
Washington's current contempt for Europe risks severely undermining long-term U.S. global influence. The Mangji elements in Washington often deride Europe as a migrant-ridden mausoleum.
But the U.S. needs to recognize that without European followership, American power will be less often welcomed or tolerated and more often resisted around the world.
Exactly. So why does Europe still matter so fundamentally to Washington, beyond just being an ally of convenience?
Well, there are two main reasons. First, the undeniable business reality. Europe is the largest and most accessible market for U.S. corporate giants. They buy $3.6 trillion worth of U.S. goods and services every year.
It's the most critical reservoir of affluent consumers. And second, geopolitically, Europe is the essential staging ground for U.S. military operations in the Middle East and Africa.
But the greatest value, the sources point out, is less tangible. It's legitimacy.
That is the key insight. Europe is the U.S. legitimacy engine. The big international systems, the IMF, the World Bank, the UN, they were fundamentally Euro-American joint ventures. With Europe on board, American preferences were smoothly turned into global norms.
So if the U.S. continues this hostility, European alienation will carry a real, tangible cost.
We're already seeing signs of it. Growing European nervousness about relying on U.S. goods. The International Criminal Court, for example, just ditched Microsoft Office for a European software suite.
So if the U.S. pushes too far, Europe will seek strategic autonomy. Less reliance on U.S. LNG, U.S. military hardware, even U.S. payment systems like Visa and MasterCard.
It's a real warning to Washington. Europe will always side with a democratic ally over an expansionist autocracy like China, but being endlessly demeaned makes them hesitate. The U.S. risks alienating its most loyal second fiddle at the exact moment it needs global legitimacy most.
Moving from the complex geopolitics of Europe, let's pivot to Asia and examine India and China, two nations stuck in what is best described as a state of armed coexistence.
5 years after that deadly Galwan clash in 2020, the relationship between India and China has seen a fragile thaw. Prime Minister Modi visited China, direct flights restarted, rare earth exports resumed.
But the central reality along the border in Ladakh is a massive, accelerating infrastructure race.
Both sides have poured capital into roads, tunnels, and air defense systems to dramatically speed up troop movement at high altitudes. But the race is heavily weighted in China's favor.
How so?
China's rate of infrastructure development is currently 4 times that of India. This is crucial because China's side of the border, Aksai Chin, is a flat plateau. This topographical advantage allows them to move heavy forces and supplies to the front line in just 2 nights, a speed India simply cannot match.
And China has also forced civilians to move closer to the border,
which effectively enables permanent troop deployment. The number of Chinese structures along the line of actual control has risen tenfold since Galwan.
And yet, despite this massive buildup and China's structural advantage, pragmatic diplomacy has actually lowered the immediate risk of a major clash.
That's the paradox of armed coexistence. The fragile diplomatic thaw has allowed for the resumption of weekly coordinated foot patrols at key flashpoints. Officers exchange a friendly wave, maintain strict distance. Indian officials confirm China now scrupulously adheres to these protocols and always answers the hotline, which is not something they do with the U.S.
But the relationship is fundamentally stuck.
As former Indian Ambassador Vijay Gokhale described it, yes, it's stuck. The vast differences in capability in China's growing military footprint in the Indian Ocean mean the tensions are persistent and deeply structural.
Shifting focus from that institutional tension to the role of the individual, India is grappling with an extreme form of personality politics.
It is a pervasive national phenomenon. Prime Minister Narendra Modi commands this elaborate cult of personality that makes him the face of his party, the state, and even local elections. His face is everywhere, on billboards, as a mascot for welfare schemes. India's largest cricket stadium is named after him.
And it extends beyond just Modi to his inner circle. We see the foreign minister promoted not just as a competent diplomat, but as a no-nonsense negotiator with lasers shooting from his eyes.
The focus is always on the superhuman qualities of the individual. But the structural cost of this personalized politics is enormous.
Because India is just too complex to be run by a handful of charismatic people.
Far too complex. 1.45 billion people, 28 states, vast disparities. This focus on personality comes at the expense of building strong state capacity and institutions that can survive bad leaders and incompetent officials. Voters reward charismatic characters because the governance structures are often weak, forcing officials to rely on personal dictate. rather than robust policy.
Meanwhile, Australia is confronting a very different kind of social and political crisis. This is following the IS-inspired Hanukkah massacre in Sydney, which killed 15 people.
The recriminations were immediate and bitter. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese was publicly booed at a vigil. He was accused by the opposition and by Netanyahu of failing to counter a significant rise in anti-Semitism since the Hamas attack in 2023.
And the government's response has been swift, but it's created a difficult political and legal debate.
Yes. Albanese unveiled the largest gun buyback scheme since the 1996 Tasmania mass shooting, which is broadly popular. But at the same time, they're tightening hate speech laws and proposing new legislation to criminalize slogans like "Globalize the Intifada."
And critics are warning this goes too far.
Yes, including the UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights. They're warning that in the rush to respond to terrorism, the government risks imposing disproportionate restrictions on expression. The challenge for Australia is balancing necessary security with protecting fundamental civil liberties.
In Southeast Asia, Myanmar is enduring a devastating reversal of fortune for the resistance forces fighting the military junta.
The junta launched brutal offenses ahead of a three-phase sham election. They're trying to acquire territory and cement their illegitimate power. The resistance's downturn was driven less by a failure of will and more by two critical external and tactical factors.
Okay, let's start with the external pressures on the rebels.
First, China, fearing instability on its border if the junta collapses, has systematically cut supply lines to rebel groups. They even kidnapped a major rebel leader who refused to sign a truce.
And the second factor?
Donald Trump's evisceration of USA. USA had focused on providing essential humanitarian services, food, medicine, education, in rebel-held areas. When that funding dried up, rebel groups had to shift millions of dollars from their military budgets to becoming the de facto government. It drained their war chest and led to significant territorial losses.
And the junta's new tactics are brutal, leveraging some surprisingly innovative asymmetric tech.
They are. On the ground, they're deploying huge waves of 80 to 100,000 Russian-trained conscripts. But it's their air tactics where you see the innovation. They've acquired Chinese drone kits and are using motorized paragliders, similar to what Hamas used against Israel, to attack clinics and schools.
So they're disrupting the rebels' ability to govern,
which is essential to winning local loyalty. The entire sham election is designed to give the regime a veneer of legitimacy to encourage its neighbors to re-engage with the illegitimate leader, Min Aung Hlaing.
That is a grim picture of traditional warfare leveraging modern, low-cost tech. Let's pivot now to the absolute frontier of technology and life itself. Applied astrobiology and the massive ethical debate around terraforming Mars.
This is a truly profound philosophical and scientific concept. The low cost of reusable heavy-lift rockets, pioneered by Elon Musk's Starship, makes the long-term goal of settling Mars actually plausible.
And this has led to the creation of a whole new field, applied astrobiology,
which is the science of studying life from Earth moving beyond its planetary confines. The ultimate goal here isn't just sending humans to survive for a few years, but fundamentally changing the planetary environment to make it permanently habitable.
Terraforming.
Terraforming. Moving beyond just maintaining habitability to creating and expanding it, using extraterrestrial minerals and ices. It reframes astrobiology from a backward-looking search for past Martian life into an active, experimental science focused on making new life possible.
But there's a huge ethical and scientific hurdle in the way of this, the planetary protection dilemma.
Yes. Current international rules strictly prohibit missions to special regions on Mars, the areas most likely to harbor microbial life, like deep caves or moist areas. This is to prevent contamination by Earth microbes.
So the dilemma is that maximizing protection minimizes the chance of actually finding any life. It puts the most interesting spots off limits.
But scientists are paralyzed. They can't find life if they can't look where it's most likely to be.
So what are the proposed solutions?
Well, either wholesale deregulation, which is politically difficult, or creative self-enlarging experiments. The most fascinating one is called solid-state greenhousing.
Okay, what is that?
You spread a thin layer of transparent material, like aerogel, over the Martian soil. This warms the ground and retains heat, creating a temporary near-surface habitable zone. Scientists are proposing this as the greatest search for life experiment you could imagine.
So you'd introduce Earth microbes to this controlled zone to see if they can take hold.
Exactly. You'd use carefully chosen photosynthetic microbes. It essentially turns the whole terraforming effort into a giant, gradual experiment to see if the barren mud ball can start turning green.
It's incredible to think about. Stepping back to terrestrial culture and economics, Let's look at China's paradoxical situation with its art market and its museums.
The collapse of China's historic art market is really striking. The Chinese art index has fallen all the way back to 2009 levels. It's mirroring the property market crash that created all that wealth in the first place. Art sales declined 31% in 2024 alone.
And this was heavily linked to the fate of those property tycoons who used flashy art deals to show off their riches. I remember the story about Liu Yukan using his Amex card to buy a $170 million artwork.
And that story symbolizes two things. First, the extreme, conspicuous opulence that the Communist Party is now actively cracking down on. They're banning social media posts that show off expensive lifestyles.
And second,
more practically, regulators worry that foreign art purchases are a prime way to get around China's strict capital controls. When liquidity is oxygen for these collapsing property firms, they sell their art to breathe. This forces big deals to stay private, which further damages the public market.
And yet, at the same time, China is having a massive museum boom, and these places are packed.
That's the extraordinary paradox. China now has 7,000 museums, attracting a staggering 1.5 billion annual visits. The boom is fueled by free admission, stunning modern exhibitions using 3D printing and holograms, and a genuine surge in national pride.
And the state, of course, uses these spaces for its own ideological agenda.
Yes, there's a strong ideological undercurrent, particularly in exhibitions about pre-modern China that subtly weave together disparate regions into a harmonious, unified national tapestry that culminates, of course, in the present political structure. The museums are a huge public success, but the private art market that fueled elite consumption is struggling desperately.
Moving from China's cultural paradox, let's talk about the literal, fragile connections of the modern world. The submarine fiber optic cables.
The entire modern world relies on what the sources call a fragile filigree of 1.4 million kilometers of unprotected fiber optic cables on the ocean floor. They carry 99% of global internet traffic.
And this network is vulnerable to everything from natural events like the underwater avalanches in Tonga.
For deliberate sabotage, as we talked about in the Baltic Sea. And geopolitical splintering is making this vital infrastructure even more perilous.
So
what used to be a multinational collaborative industry is becoming severely fragmented. The U.S. imposes strict restrictions on cable laying by ships linked to China, and China asserts a right to oversee cable laying across contested zones like the South China Sea. The recent blackout in Taiwan's Manzhou Islands, caused when Chinese vessels accidentally cut a cable, just underscores this vulnerability. The geopolitical contest is now literally taking place on the ocean floor.
That anxiety about global vulnerabilities seems to reflect broader cultural anxieties, particularly visible in the popularity of modern self-help books.
The modern self-help genre, epitomized by these incredibly successful, often saccharine books like The Boy, The Mole, The Fox, The Horse, and its sequel, it serves as a kind of archaeology of anxiety.
It's fascinating to contrast the modern genre with historical self-help.
Back in the Victorian era, self-help was all about developing will and attention. The Depression era was about visualizing wealth, but modern self-help reflects a time-poor, anxious society obsessed with the finiteness of time-like, reminding you that you only have a 4,000-week lifespan and what critics call infantile expressions of authenticity.
They also commit the sin of tiresome capitalization.
Writing key concepts in capital letters, yes.
Right.
And they prioritize the untrammeled emotion of the soypistic social media age.
And yet, philosophers argue that this intense focus on the self is actually counterproductive to fulfillment.
They do. They argue that true fulfillment comes from unselfing, focusing your attention away from yourself, towards the world, through things like socializing or nature walks. The modern self-help genre, despite often name-dropping stoicism, tends to pursue happiness in a fleeting emotional sense, rather than the classical goal of living a good, outwardly focused life.
And speaking of consumption and anxiety, we have to touch on how the rise of GLP-1 weight loss drugs like Ozempic is literally changing the world of high-end cuisine.
It's a remarkable adaptation. With an estimated 1 in 8 American adults now taking these appetite-suppressing drugs, high-end restaurants are scrambling to adjust. Otto's in London, famous for its massive, indulgent portions, has introduced a new menu of exquisite bites and mini meals.
It's a clever response that really exploits consumer psychology.
Exactly. They're exploiting the psychology that allows them to apply a huge markup on a tiny plate. The exquisite bite gives you the status, the luxury experience, and the taste, but without the volume or the guilt. As these drugs become more affordable and widespread, the restaurant industry is thinking small to maintain its profit margins.
Finally, we should note the passing of Brigitte Bardot, a remarkable cultural figure who really embodied the intense duality of self-expression and public life.
Brigitte Bardot died at 91. She made the dramatic choice to retire at 39, trading her iconic sex kitten persona for radical animal activism. She sold all her jewelry to fund her foundation.
And she channeled her immense public profile entirely into fighting animal abuse, against seal calls, factory farming, bullfighting.
But her final decades were deeply controversial because of her provocative use of language.
Right. She combined her activism with racist invective. She had 5 convictions under France's anti-racism laws. She publicly condemned Muslims as savages and also lashed out against human social movements like Me Too. She often preferred the company of her 14 dogs and 60 cats to people.
So she embodies this profound paradox, the choice to reject humanity for nature, yet her continued need to shock and court attention underscores the strange duality of self-expression in the public sphere.
Her life illustrates that even in the ultimate act of rejection, turning her back on humanity, she never stopped performing. Her rejection of humanity, channeled through racist rhetoric, was ironically her final, most controversial act of public performance.
Which secures her place in the ongoing discussion about celebrity, identity, and moral purpose.
This week reveals a world that's really grappling with the fallout of both hypercapitalism and this relentless technological acceleration. We've seen how the benefits of prosperity, like rising real wages, are often overlooked in favor of abstract anxiety. And that leads to these dangerous political calls for discredited short-term fixes.
And at the same time, the institutional frameworks, everything from Berkshire Hathaway's succession planning to the EU alliance and financial regulatory bodies, they're all being challenged by powerful, charismatic individuals. People driven by ego, by ideology, or in the case of AI, by just sheer capital burn.
So the core question for you, the listener, as you process the coming year's headlines is really this. Will the instability we're seeing across global politics, from the Baltic Sea to the Venezuelan coast and the fragility in modern finance, will it force a rational, necessary return to valuing institutional strength, regulatory rigor, and long-term structural fixes?
Or will we continue to be led, for better or worse, by charismatic individual personalities, by speculative ventures, and by emotional narratives across an increasingly fragmented and perilous world?